We were traveling well behind the German lines, and all of a sudden here in front of us was this city. It had been horribly bombed and firebombed. Total desolation. It was totally destroyed. And this was the city of Panama. On the far side of the city was another hill. And on that hill was a big high stone wall. Within it was a whole series of buildings and a big Red Cross flag on the top of the main building. And none of these buildings were touched by the bombs. So the captain of the 7th Armored came out and he said, "Well, I'm not going to move my tanks through the rubble until you, me and my men, would clean out and check, make sure there's no German anti-tank weapons there." So I took my men off the tanks and we went through the rubble. We finally came to the main gate and put TNT against it and blew it in, and then we charged up the side of the hill. And as we approached the buildings was a large group of what we call slaves, for lack of any other word in those days. We didn't have the word survivors and Holocaust then. They were in such an appalling condition. They were horribly starved. Their eyes were sunken way back in their heads. Soon, one of my men came for me, and he said, "You better come with me." And here, along one whole wall, these big, massive oak doors, but one of them was a steel door. It could only be opened from the outside. And I looked inside, and there was a shower room. And we opened the door, and I stepped inside. There was nobody in this room, but here was human waste and blood all over the room and all over the walls and so on. It was absolutely appalling to see it. And we were trying to understand what was going on, because our government and our army had never told us a word about any of these camps before. So as I looked inside, one of my men was standing apparently in the hallway, as I remember, and he called out to me. He says, "What the hell is going on here?" And I looked over, "What's the matter?" And he turned a big wheel that was over his head, and he said, "There's no water." And then some of the slaves began to explain to me that this was a gas chamber, that they would put approximately 50 people at a time in the shower room, close the door, and the doctors would turn on the carbon monoxide, and it took up to 2 hours to kill them.
On March 26, 1945, Staff Sergeant Curtis Whiteway and his men, Special Rangers attached to the United States Army's 99th Infantry Division, liberated the mental institution at Hadamar, Germany. The atrocities they encountered were the remnants of a little-known Nazi killing operation called Action T-4. Between 1939 and 1945, T-4 and related operations resulted in the deaths of over 350,000 people with disabilities, primarily mental disabilities, in Germany and German-occupied territories in Europe. In the fall of 1939, Adolf Hitler signed an order authorizing his personal physician, Dr. Karl Brandt, to oversee a program that provided what was called a mercy death to people with disabilities who were deemed incurable. This order provided cover for the psychiatrist and other doctors who engaged in mass murder through Action T-4. For although Hitler's order spoke of mercy deaths, the goal of this program was not to alleviate the suffering of the dying. Rather, it was to systematically exterminate disabled people who were referred to as useless eaters and lives unworthy of life. T-4, the code name, refers to the Tiergartenstrasse 4, the Berlin address of Hitler's chancellery, was the culmination of a political process that included passage of a law in 1933 providing for the sterilization of disabled people. This was followed by a program for the killing of newborns and infants who were, in the language of the times, deformed or feeble-minded. Dr. Peter Stasny, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, discusses the beginning of the child euthanasia program.
There was a family who had a disabled child who went to this Dr. Kattel in Leipzig and had some discussions about whether this child could be taken out of his misery, or, the way they put it, or relieved, in other words, killed by the doctors. And Kattel decided, well, that was an important issue, and he was going to bring it to the attention of Hitler. And Hitler became very interested in this, sent out his personal physician, Dr. Brandt, And within a few days, this child was killed. So starting with that, in early 1939, Hitler's chancellery became very actively involved in the killing of children. These people that organized the child euthanasia program were, of course, also interested in the adult euthanasia program, which was later to become T4. On August 8th, apparently, of 1939, they had a screening of a film, Unworthy Lives, which was not a finished film, but it was footage that had been shot in some of the institutions. And they screened that film for Hitler. And after the screening, Hitler said, let's do this. Hitler had this on his mind at least since 1935 and probably before. Of course, before there was a sterilization program. And the sterilization program was something that he already had talked about in Mein Kampf, which was published in the early 20s. But going beyond the sterilization program to actually killing people was a major step, because these were Aryans. These were their own German people. So they had to figure out a way to convince themselves that they weren't going to get in trouble for doing that.
The Nazi propaganda machine was engaged to help convince German physicians that Action T4 was needed to maintain the strength and racial purity of the German people. A series of films was made for this purpose, including one entitled Victims of the Past.
Auf dieser Erde ist Kampf ums Dasein.
All life on this earth is a struggle for existence. Everything that is weak in life will inevitably be destroyed by nature. In the last few decades, mankind has sinned terribly against the laws of natural selection. We haven't just maintained life unworthy of life. We have allowed it to multiply. Whole clans are to be found in asylums. The costs of caring for the hereditarily ill siblings of this one family has so far been 154,000 Reichmarks. How many healthy people could have been housed for this sum?
This film, like Action T4 itself, was steeped in the now discredited science of eugenics. First coined in 1881 by the British naturalist Francis Galton, eugenics was described by Charles Davenport, a leading American proponent, as the science of the improvement of the human race by better breeding. The eugenics movement believed that disease and disability, as well as social problems such as poverty, were hereditary, and that the human condition could be perfected if the poor and the disabled could be persuaded or forced not to reproduce. In 1910, financed by Carnegie, Harriman, and Rockefeller money, Davenport founded the Eugenics Record Office, or ERO, at Cold Spring Harbor, New York. Under the direction of Dr. Harry Laughlin, the ERO became the leading center for eugenic research in the United States, and worked to prove that biological manipulation would result in better social planning. Dr. Patricia Deegan is a psychologist and former mental patient whose work at Boston University's Institute for the Study of Human Resilience focuses on the history of psychiatry from the perspective of patients. She talks about the impact of eugenics on Action T4.
These eugenic developments were paralleled also in Germany. But it is important for people to know that the United States was seen as a leader in developing model involuntary sterilization laws. And Harry Laughlin, the U.S. congressional expert consultant on eugenics, did receive an honorary doctorate at the University of Heidelberg in 1936. And so what we find is that the roots run long and deep, and that you really have to look at a broad picture in a number of different countries to see the power of eugenics, which swells like a tide, if you will, coming up, and then allowing a culture in a totalitarian society then to begin to cross over into a whole other thing, which is about euthanasia, so-called mercy killing, and ultimately the mass murder through formal measures such as gassing, injection, electrocution on electroshock machines, as well as more informal procedures such as letting people starve to death.
most of the people who were involved in this at the beginning were early party members that were very rabid Nazis, and whose theory really was that they're not only treating individuals, but they're treating the body of the people. And one metaphor they always used was, if the German people had a diseased leg, they have to cut it off, amputate it, to save the rest of the body. And this is one way they convinced themselves that this was the right thing to do, by saying they're not just treating individuals, but they're saving the German race, purifying it, cleansing it from this infectious, toxic waste, really. They considered people with disabilities toxic to the rest of the nation, even more so than Jews, in a certain way, because they were their own people.
And I turned my attention to a huge pile of human hair. As I walked over there, I slung my rifle, and I stood in front of the pile of human hair, and I put my hand up over my head. That pile was higher than my hand. Somebody explained to me, one of the slaves, that they shaved all the hair off every part of the human body, and they collected all this hair, and then they would sell the hair to the manufacturers in Germany to make mattresses, make winter coats, stuff like that.
So one of the things they did right away in the summer of 1939 is develop a form that was to be filled out by all physicians caring for people with disabilities, especially with mental disabilities. And then they created a review committee of several trusted doctors. The forms came to Berlin, and the doctors that were on the committee, many of which were very prominent psychiatrists, such as Karl Schneider, who is still thought to be one of the most important contributors to research on schizophrenia, and various others. And they reviewed the forms, and they decided, based on their review of the information, which person was going to get killed. Of course, only a very, very small percentage of people ended up living. The vast majority of people who had forms filled out ended up being transported to killing centers.
What's also terrifying is that on record, we know of only one judge and one asylum superintendent who actually refused to fill out the forms and participate. And so with participation so widespread, it really begins to make us wonder about what is possible for us as humans in terms of our own inhumanity.
The way it started to work in the fall of 1939, once Hitler had written his famous order taking the doctors off the hook. Once that was in place, they started to look for institutions that could be used as killing centers. These places, such as Hartheim, Hadamar, and others, they were being prepared for the task that they were going to have. And these were relatively small institutions, because they knew that people weren't going to stay there for very long. Their sole purpose at that point was to figure out how to most efficiently kill as many people as possible. So once these places had been identified and outfitted with, for instance, gas chambers, but they all had crematoria because they all needed to burn the corpses once people were killed.
And now on the end of the room was a series of ovens on fire. I have no idea. We never counted things like this in the combat. We just examined and were shocked at the things that we kept finding. As I walked over to the battery of ovens, and I looked at inside one, and here was the bodies inside them burning. And then there was another man came over, and he began to cry. And he looked at me, and he spoke broken English, and he said, "They," meaning the hospital staff, "would take and throw young children and babies alive in those ovens on top of the bodies." And then he broke down crying, and he fell down on his knees on the floor in front of me, and he cried his heart out.
They figured out several different ways of transporting people. They used initially buses from the postal service, and people started to know what those buses were after a while, especially when they lived near those killing centers. Because the way it was described by people who saw it was that very soon after a bus arrived, a large cloud of smoke lifted off from that institution. And of course, they had to have special people to do this job. So they recruited people locally sometimes, but many of the people were trained in Berlin and came from the core group of doctors and nurses. But there were plenty doctors from the provinces who became involved in the transporting and in the actual killing.
How do you get physicians and nurses and general practitioners to participate in the mass killing of people with disabilities? And I think that that's one of the most extraordinary achievements of the Third Reich, was to tap the potential of medicine to become willing allies in the mass murder of lives deemed unworthy of life.
Elvira Manthe was one of those identified as a life unworthy of life. The child of a family on welfare, she was diagnosed as feeble-minded at age 7 and placed in an institution. More than 50 years later, she returned to visit that institution and recalled her experiences there.
Also, der Bus hielt, es wurde aufgemacht und wir mussten aussteigen.
So the bus stopped. They opened the door and we had to get off. I was always fast, so I got off the bus quickly. Then we went into that room. In that room, they said. There were people there in white coats. On the right, there was a door, an iron door with bars. The woman who had traveled with us started giving us orders. Quick, get undressed, hurry up. There was a pile of clothes and a heap of shoes. The children got undressed. She even helped them. It was all very quick. Then she yelled at me, "Get undressed!" And I got undressed slowly, almost in slow motion. Then I saw all those children. They were being pulled by their arms by that woman and pushed behind the iron door. The door was locked after every child. I didn't realize what had happened until after the war, when we found out about the killing of Jews and the euthanasia program. Then I realized that the children had been gassed, and that I had been allowed to turn back in front of the gas chamber. I was asked, "What is your name? How old are you?" And because I was able to answer, I very narrowly escaped death, but not the many children who were sent to their deaths through that iron door. The more I see it, the more it loses its horror. I must come to grips with it, or I will lose my mind.
One of the main points about this killing was that it was medical, and that it was actually doctors who turned on the gas and who turned off the gas when people were dead, and who observed the dying through a window pane. Once the people were taken off the bus, they were duped into thinking that they were going to be taking showers. And we know this, of course, from the concentration camps where millions of Jews were killed. But this is the place where they invented this. This is the place where they first told people you were now going to take a shower, and in fact, they were getting killed there. When I spoke to Simon Wiesenthal about this, he said he didn't think that the Holocaust would have ever happened in this manner the way it did without them doing this to people with mental disabilities first. He didn't think that the SS would have been able to train people adequately in doing the killings of Jews, if not first doing these killings. So I think it's unfortunate that Holocaust historians and the Holocaust museums do not emphasize it more. I think it has a lot to do with this blurring of the boundaries and with the doctors taking such an active role. I think people still don't want to point the finger too hard at doctors. We need to reconcile that. We need to reconcile where that comes from, and I don't think we're there yet. And the medical profession is certainly not making a big effort at finding that out about itself. And psychiatry, even less so. And some people just want it to go away. They don't want to think about it.
56 years later, the memory of what he found at the Hadamar Killing Center still haunts Curtis Whiteway, and he is committed to ensuring that the victims of Action T4 are not forgotten. Speaking at schools, at churches, at meetings of disability rights groups, Whiteway describes the horror he witnessed and works to overcome prejudice and hatred.
There's a lot of hatred all over the world, and the hatred being taught generation after generation. Somebody's got to step in and teach against the hatred. And you just can't take it for granted. You've got to teach against it. That's what I'm trying to do now, today.